Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
It's a program where we pay to idle marginal crop land.
Undersecretary for Farm Production and Conservation, Robert Bonney.
And we now can enroll grasslands as well. And we basically pay an annual rental fee for 10 to 15 years and do some conservation practices on those lands to improve them for wildlife and water quality and other benefits. So it's a way to partner with folks in agriculture to conserve lands. And even while we maintain those lands for future agricultural use, if that's what the landowner wants to do, we would encourage people to go into their county offices to talk to folks there about both the general CRP, but also there may be some continuous enrollments that would be attracted to them as well. We've got a grasslands program. We're enrolling grasslands. That's a working lands program, so we can keep those lands in livestock production even while we provide environmental benefits. So for our cattle and sheep producers and others, there may be some opportunities there as well.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
You know, as we continue, you know, last week the president signed into law six appropriation bills, ag and USDA being one of them.
Chandler Gould is CEO of the National Association of Wheat Growers.
But there's still, defense and labor, HHS, financial services, homeland security, that still has not been funded. And currently the House and the Senate are working on getting the rest of the government funded. And every day that we do not have full funding for all government agencies is continuing to delay the ability to work on a five-year farm bill and get it passed. And as you mentioned, I know both chair and ranking of the Senate and House Agriculture Committee are very eager to get a bill done this year. I know that Chairman Thompson on the House side has said that he wanted to have a markup in March, but we are cruising into that Easter recess pretty quickly here. I know none of us, or at least the wheat growers, have not seen any legislative language. And honestly, Tony, I've been doing this. This will be my fifth farm bill. So that means I've been in D.C. for over 20 years. If we don't have something out of the committees and across both chamber floors by April, May, and conference, I just don't think we're going to be able to get it done this year. The presidential campaign started with Super Tuesday, and honestly, it started several months before that. But, I mean, we are now in full presidential campaign mode, and it's going to be very difficult to get a farm bill through because those two issues is going to take all the air out of both chambers. And then whether it's because each party wants to make the other party take difficult votes or this or that. And to be honest, I don't know that we want to be caught up in presidential elections. So maybe even another year extension would be better for us. But the biggest concern with an additional extension is we continue to lose baseline, meaning we have less and less money every day to write a new farm bill.
But with recent announcements pushing for more sustainable aviation fuel, Gould warns.
Absolutely. I want to be very clear as I make this next statement. Of course, there's a lot of things we need to be looking for. But we continue to see a decline in wheat acreage in the United States. And I want to be clear that the National Association of Wheat Growers, we are very supportive of renewable fuels. We are very supportive of the renewable fuel standard, the RFS. But I think we would have our heads stuck in the sand if we didn't continue to raise just some of the economic concerns with the advanced aviation biofuels. And by that, what I'm really talking about is when you give a commodity like camelina a wider margin and larger profit earning capabilities because it is going to have a direct need with a new renewable fuel standard, so advanced aviation biofuels. And if you look at where camelina is predominantly grown and planted, it literally fits right over a big chunk of our winter wheat belt here in the United States. And if you're a grower and you have a guaranteed margin that's going to generate revenue because it is going to a renewable fuels standard that has to be met, or plant wheat, which, you know, rises and falls with the market value, I am worried that we're going to be competing for acres against camelina, and I can see a significant issue with that as renewable fuels continue to take off, which are needed. We appreciate the clean energy, but I don't want to see it at the expense of the largest food grain industry in the United States.
Chandler Gould, CEO, National Association of Wheat Growers. It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
So how is it that we're spending, you know, these large, expected to spend these large sums in, 26, 27 and beyond?
Former administrator of USDA's Farm Service Agency and University of Illinois farm policy expert, Jonathan Kappas.
And a lot of it is due to how the price loss coverage program works. And that is Congress sets a fixed price. Let's take wheat, for example. Wheat's reference price is $5.50. If during the course of the 12-month marketing year following wheat harvest, the national average price received by farmers is below that $5.50, we trigger payments. And so when CBO does their calculations, they estimate, you know, they forecast, they use USDA forecasts and others to try to get an estimate of where prices are going to be over this long, long 10-year window. And here you can see in particular wheat expected to be below its reference price in the out years, so 26 and beyond. And that's triggering a large amount of those payments. Soybeans, by comparison, is expected to stay well above its reference price of $8.40 and likely not to trigger any payments. Corn's a little bit closer to that reference price, so it's feeding some expectations of spending there, but not a lot. By comparison, looking at our other three major crops and major both in terms of acreage, but also in terms of the political influence, if you will, a political footprint in these discussions. If we look at our southern crops, cotton, rice, and peanuts, we can see quite a bit of difference in the way the PLC program operates for these crops. So all three of them are expected to be below their reference prices in the out years. Now, again, this is likely to adjust when CBO re-forecasts. But peanuts, I think, is probably the one that jumps out the most. And it was projected in May to be well below its reference price. So the expectations in this program would be payments every year and large payments for peanuts, which if we take the expected outlays that CBO projected back in May and we divide it by the number of base acres that are in the program, this is what it looks like year over year, crop by crop. The main takeaway here is the importance of where that reference price is set. It's also a reminder of this baseline challenge because rice and peanuts are the smallest crops in the program. So if you increase their reference price, you can spend a lot more money per acre on those crops and those farmers who have base acres of those crops, but it doesn't show up in the baseline the same way. And this is, you know, a bit of a challenge for crops like corn and soybeans. Soybeans in particular, if we go back up here a minute, if soybeans want to move that reference price closer to where the forecasted prices are going to be, we're talking 50, 60 million acres potentially expected in that program, which is going to spend a lot more money in the baseline and be extraordinarily costly over a 10-year window. And so it challenges these larger crops under this baseline sort of zero-sum game that they cannot as easily increase the trigger points for program payments because they're paying out on such large acreage. And large acreage with payments over 10 years is extraordinarily expensive in the baseline. So this is, if you will, this is sort of a rough perspective around some of the politics at the committee level in particular, around how these programs are created, how we negotiate things like the fixed reference price in the statute, kind of who wins and loses in that undertaking. And certainly, you know, these politics break out on the regional lines because the southern crops are getting these larger payments every year. And, you know, their membership is more likely wanting to protect that or improve that. And so these are some of the indicators of the political challenges that we'll see at the committee level in particular. A lot of this won't get worked out on a floor debate because it's pretty deep in the weeds of the policy, but it certainly is something that the committees will work a lot on.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
So artificially cheap, unhealthy food is not the problem.
Talking farm food and policies and practices behind dietary health, Dr. Robert Parlberg.
And the low availability of healthy food is not the problem either. In fact, as our dietary health crisis was worsening after 1970, fresh fruit and vegetable availability per capita was increasing. Even when adjusted for spoilage and plate waste, fresh fruit per capita availability up by 40%, vegetable availability up 21%, per capita availability of broccoli increased 13-fold. Much of this increased availability was made possible by imports, including from tropical countries and also off-season imports from southern hemisphere countries. We import one-third of our vegetable consumption, when half of our fruit consumption and 80% of our seafood consumption, of course, if these imports weren't there, our nation's dietary health crisis would be even worse.
Paro Berg is author of Resetting the Table, Straight Talk About the Food We Grow and Eat.
Now, some try to explain America's dietary health problem by claiming that healthy foods are more expensive than unhealthy foods, but that's not true either. If you look at the period from 1980 to 2006, USDA study shows that average retail prices for healthy foods fell at the same rate as for calorie-dense foods. Once you adjust for inflation and once you adjust for quality, processing, and seasonality. If you look at the next slide, at apples on the left and chocolate chip cookies on the right, you can see that the price was the average annual change in prices was showing almost an identical trend. But there's another argument out there that some Americans, especially poor inner city Americans, don't have a healthy diet because they lack physical access to the supermarkets that sell fresh fruits and vegetables. They live in what are called food deserts. This is a politically appealing argument because you don't have to blame the poor for their poor diet. It doesn't blame food companies or supermarkets either. That's politically convenient. It says we just need more supermarkets, mostly in poor neighborhoods. This is a popular argument, but the latest research shows that it's not a particularly reliable.
So if the problem is not food deserts, what is it?
A couple of studies, 2011 study, actually found no connection between grocery store access and healthful diets. A 2014 study found that low-income Americans actually enjoy closer proximity to supermarkets than Americans who are not so poor. Other studies have looked at what happens to diets when new supermarkets arrive in a community, and we learn that diets don't change much. It's because supermarkets sell junk food along with healthy food. They often make choosing an unhealthy diet more convenient and more affordable. So the real problem isn't food deserts. It's what are called food swamps. If we define a food swamp as a neighborhood with at least four times as many fast food restaurants and convenience stores compared to supermarkets and grocery stores, these food swamps are a stronger prediction of obesity than food deserts. And in fact, if you control for food swamps, the influence of food deserts disappears. It falls to zero.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
We utilize resources under the Commodity Credit Corporation to establish the Regional Agricultural Promotion Program.
Ag Secretary Tom Vilsack speaking at Commodity Classic.
But now this gives us a tremendous opportunity to focus on those lower level markets. It allows us to have more people, more promotions, more presence in those markets, to be able to continue to do the job that you all do on the farm, which is to tout the stability and the safety and the quality of what we raise in this country. In fact, the Deputy Secretary, Tora Small, is currently in Africa, having spent nearly a week there, touring a number of countries in an effort to try to promote more opportunity. During that period of time, she and those who accompany her on this trade mission have already participated in 122 separate meetings with potential buyers of agricultural commodities. So it's an opportunity for us to do this in an expanded way. This is one of seven trade missions that will take place in 2024, again focused on diversifying our market opportunity. This effort on exports also involves engagement. I mentioned China. For the first time, I had the opportunity to physically meet with the Chinese Ag Minister. We had an exchange of ideas. We had a commitment to work collaboratively on issues of significance to both China and the United States. Understanding that our relationship in agriculture is an important one. It's important to us because it's a significant market. It's important to them because they are not a food secure nation as we are. They don't have the level of productivity and the enormous landmass and the water resources that we have. And the result is that they are dependent on others for food. And we are more than willing to do our part in providing that. So we will see a closer working relationship on issues related to climate change, related to ways in which technology, biotechnology specifically, can be utilized in order to increase productivity and to be able to assure that those commodities using biotechnology are made available in the marketplace. Engagement also involves our other two top customers, Mexico and Canada. And for that reason, I'm announcing today that I will have a trilateral meeting with the ministers from Canada and the secretary from Mexico later this month, likely in Colorado, to have an opportunity for us to discuss areas of mutual concern, for me to continue to raise the concern we have in Mexico in their approach to biotechnology in terms of corn, and for me to also raise the need for Canada to continue to look for ways in which their dairy market can be more open to us. This effort on exports also involves enforcing trade agreements, which we are doing in a variety of ways, Mexico and Canada being two areas. It also involves reducing barriers, focusing on individual trade barriers that exist in countries around the world to our products. It's one of the reasons why I was happy to note that ethanol exports are up, and one of the reasons is that we're beginning to see other countries understand and appreciate the necessity of having higher volumes of blended fuel in their gas consumption. Japan indicating recently a willingness to increase their level of biofuel is as an example. These are all negotiated, all encouraged by us at USDA in order to enhance opportunities for exports.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
We're looking at climate neutrality in beef and dairy. Climate neutrality is that point where we are no longer adding warming to the climate.
Joe Proudman is Associate Director of Communications with the CLEAR Center at UC Davis on repairing the narrative around livestock and climate.
It's significant for our sector because at the end of the day, methane is our Achilles heel, right? Methane is a strong, potent gas that has a very, very short lifespan, much different than carbon dioxide. In fact, they're almost complete opposites, right? Not as powerful. Methane is 28 more times powerful, but has a much longer lifespan. All the carbon dioxide that we emit today will be here for generations, thousands of years. Because of that, though, and you hear this a lot, methane is our quickest tool to reduce emissions, to reduce temperatures, or to slow climate change, is because it is that short lifespan that does it. And we get to that point, if we have constant emissions, so you don't grow your herd size, we will not be adding additional warming to the atmosphere. It's a very, very rudimentary explanation of it. But generally, that's what we're talking about. The key is, though, if you reduce it, then we have really good things. Only two sectors can pull carbon out of the atmosphere. That is agriculture and forestry. So the opportunity that we have to do that is immense and to be part of a climate solution. So we really do talk about climate neutrality. When somebody talks about carbon neutrality, they're essentially talking about the same thing, right? If your primary greenhouse gas you emit is carbon dioxide, you get to zero emissions or you balance that out, you're at climate neutrality. So it's analogous. We talk a lot about dairy digesters. I'm going to show you a research paper we just did around that. We look at feed additives. In those bubbles, we'll often look at additives. So like say we're feeding them maybe like agolin or something like that, you know, where we're seeing how much methane they can reduce. I mentioned we had protein intake. We did a recent trial with Cargill on that. And then we're looking at how we measure methane emissions. Right now, you know, GWP 100 is kind of standard. It'll continue to be the standard, but it doesn't always account for methane's short lifespan and the consequences of that. So we talk a lot about GWP star, which is just another matrix, another way to measure how methane emissions are impacting our climate. This white paper it just came out, and this white paper was written. We called it the Three Amigos paper because it was written with Dr. Frank Mittlener, Dr. Ermias Cabreab, and Dr. Daniel Sumner. These are three of the leading scientists in this field. Frank and Ermias looking at how we're reducing emissions in animals, and Dan looking at the economics around agriculture and livestock. We presented this paper to the California Air Resources Board, the California Department of Food and Agriculture, the CDFA, and also the California EPA the other day, just to talk about, hey, what we're doing in the dairy sector, the emissions we're reducing, and how we're doing it, it's working. And we will meet state goals by 2030 if we continue to aggressively mitigate and incentivize these mitigations. And of course, right now I'm talking about digesters, right, on the dairy side. Digesters have been an immensely powerful tool for us at the end of the day to reduce emissions. Farmers have an income, but we've also reduced 30% of our goal so far. One thing we know is that that goal, that number, that 30%, it doesn't account for all the digesters we have. We're probably much, much further along there. We further talk about the need to tackle enteric emissions and how if we really still want to reduce emissions, incentivizing those will be beneficial. Of all the California climate investments the state has invested in, they've invested only 2% of those dollars into digesters and alternative manure management programs, but those have reduced 30% of the emissions in that program. By far, the most effective use of funds in that program so far. So we try to be the conveners, you know, between academics, the industry, regulators, and whoever else, and consumers as well.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
With, you know, limited well capacities, and again, just it's just so dry. Meeting those water needs is going to be tough.
In the past, dealing with drought, Dr. Ed Barnes with Cotton Incorporated says it's important to have irrigation tools.
And so one of the things, in West Texas there, Jim Burdowski was a longtime ag engineer, did some really, groundbreaking work on understanding how to manage water in cotton. You know, and he showed pretty conclusively that a lot of pre-watering is not a good use of that water. So, you got to have water to get the crop out of the ground, but trying to bank it, he's demonstrated over many years that that's just not a good way to go. You really want to save that water for when the crop's up, when you're starting to get squares and flowers on it. That's when you're going to get the biggest return on your investment. So that's one, kind of easy thing. And then it gets, more challenging as the crop gets up and you start thinking, okay, when do I put that next irrigation out? And so there are a lot of tools out there. And if you'll bear with me, I'll call out Cotton Cultivated again, just so people can find some of those tools. If you go to that website, you'll see pretty close to the top of the page, as you scroll a little bit down, there's a button called Production. And you click on Production, and then it'll bring up kind of the different protection steps during the year. And one of those is water management. And so you click on water management, and that's going to pull up a lot of the water management resources around the country. You can even go one step further, and if you want to filter it down to the region, you can filter it down, say you're in the Southwest, you can filter it down so you only get, kind of information relative to the Southwest. So that's a tool that I would encourage people to take a look at.
And through the website Cotton Cultivated.
Just Google Cotton Cultivated and it'll get you there. And once you get into that water management section, for a lot of the Southwest, there's going to be, and hopefully many people are aware of this, but there's a Texas ET network. There'll be a link to that site that will Texas A&M maintains, where you can find different weather stations in the Texas area that will kind of give a sense of how much ET is occurring or how much water is evaporating or potentially could evaporate. And then there's also a link, and I have kind of a fond memories of this, Oklahoma Mesonet, which give away my age a little bit, but I was working at Oklahoma State when they were finishing up that Mesonet, and that's a weather station in every county. And so that's a really great resource, and they have an irrigation planner that's available there. So there's a lot of specific scheduling resources. Another one we're working on that won't come up under the Southwest page because we're still kind of refining it for the Southwest, but we do have it linked in with Oklahoma Mesonet, and that's a smart irrigation app for your phone that, again, will be under that water management tab. And that can be – that's in both the Apple Store and the Android Play Store. So it gives you a way to get, kind of predictions of what's the water status in your exact field.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
When it comes to USDA's latest look at our nation's crop production, supplies, and prices, not much change can be reported. What was notable in the March crop production forecast and balance sheets were price adjustments for various commodities. The season-ending average price for corn was adjusted a nickel lower than the previous month at $4.75 a bushel. Wheat prices on the average were also adjusted down 5 cents month over month, now at $7.15 a bushel. Both soybean and cotton season-ending average prices remained unchanged from February. The season-ending average price for rice, however, was increased 40 cents to $18.80 per hundredweight. Turning to production, all U.S. orange production numbers rose less than 1% from the previous forecast. I'm Rod Bain reporting in Washington, D.C.